Let's start with a quick word of prayer. Dear Lord, we thank you for this opportunity to be together, to learn more about our brothers and sisters in Christ. We thank you that we have this lovely space in which to meet, and we thank you for the holiday season, which started with the fun of little children running around last night in Halloween and leading up to the birth of your son, Jesus. We ask that you be with us today as we try to expand our knowledge, and we ask all this in Jesus' name, amen. Well, as Ms. Kyle says, I'm going to talk about Hannah Kellohill Penn. The pronunciation Penn is the easiest name I get to pronounce. The names of some of these people are a little hard to... So if I start stumbling over them, I ask for forgiveness in advance. Hannah is William Penn's second wife, and but you know, the problem with talking about people in at any point is that they all come in context, and you cannot talk about Hannah Penn as if she appears in a puff of smoke or a grew like Topsy. She comes in the midst of a whole historical milieu, and it's going to be hard to understand her and these people that we're going to deal with unless we sort of do a little bit of historical background. The trick about history, as I used to tell my students, is that you have to get out of yourself. You cannot look at these people as if they are 21st century Americans, because they're not. They're 17th and 18th century, basically, British people. And that is a very, very different social and political and religious milieu to be in. So people are people are people. But they have very different experiences and structures on their conduct. So we're going to deal with a little of that. But let's start with the Quakers. William Penn was a Quaker. Hannah Kellohill Penn was also a Quaker. The Quakers are very prominent in this story, so it helps to get a little background on the Quakers. We all remember that yesterday was the anniversary of the start of the Protestant Reformation, when in 1517 Martin Luther nailed his famous 95 Theses on the door of the Wittenberg Chapel, offering to debate them with the local Catholic authorities. The effects of the Reformation obviously go on and on and on for hundreds of years, but that is, in a sense, a starting point for this, the experiences of the Penns. In the first 70 years of the 17th century, which is the 1600s, for those who don't think in century numbers, in the first 70 years in England is a time of great religious and political upheaval. The state religion is and remains Anglicanism the Church of England through the whole period, but the official religion is under attack by the Puritans. The irony of having James, who is a suspect after Elizabeth dies in 1603, James, who is the first, who is a suspect Catholic, Charles I, who is clearly a Catholic. So you have at least one clear Catholic king who was also the head of the Anglican Church. A minor bit of irony. In the meantime, the Parliament, increasingly controlled by the Puritans, has decided that the king has too much power. The king has decided the parliament is a pain in the neck, and they are at loggerheads. The Puritans and the merchant class on the one hand, and the aristocrats and the Anglican Church on the other hand. In the end, of course, this ends up in a civil war. Charles gets his head cut off in 1649. We have 10 years of Cromwell's protectorate and the Puritans in charge. That comes to an end in 1660. And the throne is restored with James or Charles II, followed by James I, who it turns out is Charles can sort of hold this together. James is an idiot and can't. He creates his own rebellion against him, which comes in the form of William of Orange, who happens to be married to a woman who's in. Mary, who's in line, the sort of general line of the British monarchy, and they come zipping over he comes zipping over in 1688 in the so-called Glorious Revolution, which I always think is hilarious because he's got 100 ships with him filled with soldiers. It's an armed invasion. The British always talk about not being invaded after 1066, but William's is an invasion. By any stretch of the imagination. They fight a few battles. James takes off to the continent, and that's the end of that. Well, that's a rather a large amount of confusion going on as to what is the proper religion. Religion has been argued about since the Reformation starts. Here now you have kings and queens changing religion, and they change the religion, and then they die, and another king or queen takes over, and we have another religion. So it's back and forth and back and forth. Plus, you have the king's head cut off, for heaven's sakes. So it turns out the Pope is not the representative of God on earth, and it turns out the king is not the representative, or at least ordained by God. It turns out the parliament can cut his head off. This is a lot to absorb for anybody, let alone these people. So everything that they thought was true at the start, at 1603 when Elizabeth died, is all up and for grabs for basically the vast bulk of the century. That's quite a way to start. In any period in which we have a lot of dislocation, particularly with respect to religion, and then other kinds of dislocation just add to it. Various kinds of religious thinkers invent various kinds of new sects to explain the issues that are going on, because it's clear that the existing religions have a few problems, and people become uncomfortable with them, and so other people say, hey, look, here's another thing. So there's a whole series of really odd sects that pop up in England. They don't last very long, but because there's all this ferment that's going on. So one of these sects is the Quakers. The George Fox is the founder of the Quakers, and George doesn't really, he's in the midst of this confusion. George doesn't join up with any one of the religions. He, like these other sects, looks around and says, this Anglicanism, Puritanism, just Catholicism is not doing it for me. Not doing it for a lot of other people. There's obviously problems, or they wouldn't all be at each other's throats all the time. And, of course, they also have, the English have the example from 1618 to 1648 of the 30 Years' War, which is an extraordinarily bloody fight for 30 years over religion in the German territories. And tens of thousands of people are killed not all because of their religion. There's a lot of looting going on, but it's all religious driven. And so one has only to look over there and say, you know, these Protestants and Catholics are a long way from Jesus. So perhaps we ought to rethink this. So Fox is what they called a seeker. Fox is looking to find the answer. And he and others like him are busy trying to think, oh, well, what is the truth? What should be here? What is the way in which we should properly be worshiping God and finding God's plan for our life? So in 1643, he starts what he calls the Society of Friends, and what, after a while, people took derisively to calling the Quakers, which the Quakers decided didn't really bother them too much. I sort of use the word two terms interchangeably because most people do. But to themselves, they are the Society of Friends, and they speak of each other as friends, you know, not as fellow Quakers. George's point is that the Holy Spirit lives in everyone. And baptized, not baptized, doesn't matter. The Holy Spirit lives in everyone. And therefore, there is in everyone a potential inner light. And the trick is to let the inner light, which is to say the Holy Spirit, loose in your life and follow the teachings, the guidance of the Holy Spirit, which is already in you. And, you know, the best way to do this is to sit down and shut up. So the Quaker meetings are very quiet. You sit quietly. When they have a meeting, because they don't have church services, they have meetings. When you have a meeting, you sit. Now, in those days, they had men on one side, women on the other side, but you would sit quietly, and no one said anything while we waited for the inner light to speak to us. And then, if the inner light spoke to you, you would stand up and say what it is the inner light has said to you. And then you would sit down, and we would have more silence. And somebody else would then, felt moved to speak, would stand up and speak. They may speak to the first point, they may speak to their own point, they can speak to anything. And that's the way the service went. And if you've ever been to a real Quaker wedding, you go and you sit. And you sit. While people wait for the inner light. And then somebody may stand up and say, well, this is a beautiful day. It's a great, I think it's a great start for Bob and Mary getting married. And then they sit down and sit for a while. And somebody else says something and then, you know, sit for a while. And after a while, Bob and or Mary gets up and says, well, a few things about each other or love or whatever, and thanks everyone for coming, and we all declare them married. And everyone who is present signs a document that they have been present at this wedding. That's the wedding. They held business meetings in the same way. You can imagine trying to do business at Westminster this way, but you would go and sit quietly, and anybody who had a thought about the business of the community would speak up and say, you know, well, I've noticed it's dripping from the roof up there on the third floor. Perhaps we ought to do something about that. But you sit quietly while you this things come to you. Because you don't have a minister. And because it's all, this is sort of like the priesthood of all believers taken to the nth degree, right? And so you don't, you know, don't need a minister because it's all internal. Now they have people who are called elders in one thing or another who are sort of administrators, but they don't stand up and give speeches. They don't lead anybody in anything much. Some of them are out proselytizing. The Quakers are good at proselytizing, but they're, you know, they don't need ministers. Also, since we're talking about something that's internal, you don't really need fancy buildings. In fact, the plainer the building, the better, because then the building doesn't distract you from finding the inner light, right? You don't have little icons and doodads and decorations to confuse you. So the buildings are very plain. The Quakers believe that God has made everyone equal and does not recognize any distinction between people, no distinctions of rank or wealth or anything of the sort. So they reflect that. They dress plainly. So they all dress like people on oatmeal cans, right? They all dress like what we think Quakers dress like. Now, people being people, it does turn out that if you have money, the plainness is a little fancier, cloth, but we'll sort of ignore that part. They dress plainly because because obviously dressing fancily creates distinctions between people, and they don't want to create distinctions between people. The other fallout from that is they don't recognize the distinctions that society recognizes, and so they don't tip their hats to anyone. They don't remove their hat in the presence of the king. The kings, just sort of tolerated this, and many of them were mildly bemused by the whole thing. I think largely because if you're the king, you're the king, and if there's a small group of weird people who don't tip their cap, don't take off their hats in your presence, so be it. You know, everybody else will because they have good reasons to. The lesser parts of the aristocracy really didn't like this at all because, of course, it threatened their position. If you don't acknowledge them as being important, soon people might start to think about, well, why are these people where they are? And that's a tough question. So they really didn't like this hat-tipping thing. At one point in his life, Penn and some other Quakers were meeting with Peter, a prince of the Russian royal family who will become Peter the Great, and they don't take their caps off either in front of Peter, and Peter pretends not to notice that they haven't done proper recognition of the fact that he is the heir apparent to the Russian throne. So that was the Quakers. The one of the few times where it's known that the Quaker men took their hats off was at the funeral of Thomas Clarkson in the 19th century, who is the person who was most responsible for ending slavery in England and in the colonies. And he was a Quaker. And when he was buried, the Quaker men all took their hats off, something they don't do. So that's them. Oh, and they referred to everybody as thee and thou because, of course, then you don't have to call them Lord and whatever. They just called everybody the same thing, equally annoying to judges and whatever. because they don't believe that there's any reason to take oaths, that all this swearing to God stuff is not appropriate, and so they won't do it, which causes considerable problem because in order to keep the Catholics out of government, there are a whole series of laws about things that you can't do unless you swear an oath of loyalty to the government and an agreement with the Anglican Church. And the Catholics, true Catholics, won't do this, so they're excluded from the government. Well, the Quakers probably would, many of them would have sworn the oath, but for the fact they don't swear oaths. So they're excluded from the government, they're excluded from teaching, they're excluded from law, they're excluded from all kinds of things. And they can't vote because they won't sign the oaths. This leaves them with basically only one thing to do. If you're a bright young Quaker man, there's only one thing left to do, being a merchant. And the Quakers are really good at it. They're, first off, They're honest. They are dead honest, and they're reliable. If a Quaker says he's going to deliver so much stuff at a certain time in a certain place, it shows up. So if you're a business person, this is really great. You know, have a reliable person to deal with. So they're reliable, they're honest, they're very disciplined, and they're frugal. So they manage to, you know, many of them manage to accumulate large sums of money. So the Quakers get a, you know, are, although they don't get to participate in the society in the formal fashion, the fact they've got money means they have leverage. Because a lot of people would like them to either do business with them or give them the money or support them in something. So they have an importance beyond their numbers. Any rate, William Penn. It's hard to talk about Hannah Callahill Penn without talking about her husband. William Penn is born in 1644. We think of William as, if we think of him at all, as the founder of Pennsylvania, whoopee. And there's a famous picture of him meeting with the Indians under a tree, signing a treaty. I mean, in his Quaker outfit, which if you look at it very carefully, is clearly an outfit made, which was not cheap to buy. But nonetheless, looks plain. That's all we think about William Penn. You can't understand what's going on with this if you don't get that William Penn is a big, gigantic deal. William is comes from a well-to-do gentry family. His father was a famous sea captain. They have connections into the government, et cetera, et cetera. But at some point along the road, William becomes... runs into Quakers and thinks they sound sensible, and the more he runs into them and talks to them, the more sensible they sound. And finally, when he's in Ireland looking at the family estates, he goes to a Quaker meeting and basically announces that he's been convinced. Quakers don't convert, they become convinced. So he starts out having now become a Quaker. He goes home and has a somewhat difficult conversation, needless to say, with his father, and says, "Dad, you'll never guess." it's a little like your kid coming home and saying, "Hi, I've become a Muslim." And after all, it's the same God, and they recognize the same scriptures as we do. It's really not that different than being a Presbyterian. His father doesn't buy this either. And so they have a little bit of a falling out, although they reconcile. But Penn now, armed with, you know, money, I mean, he's got money, and he's a powerful speaker, he's a well-educated person, he has been trained as a lawyer, he goes out and does a lot of proselytizing, which they describe as speaking the truth, and also defending the friends who are frequently arrested, including Penn, because they just make up excuses to arrest them for preaching, even if they're preaching in their own meeting house or someplace they've rented. They arrest them anyways. Penn in and out of jail his whole life, normally not for long periods of time, but he's in and out of jail. He forms a committee to defend the friends who are being arrested. He provides legal advice and legal planning for dealing with this. He's very important to them. In the meantime, his father dies. He inherits all of the estates. He's got estates in Ireland. He's got estates in England. He, is very dynamic and is very much friendly with the government and friendly with the king, depending on who is king. They have issues with each other, but he has connections and influence. Far be, because he can't be a member of the government, right? He can't, because won't sign the oath. But he's always fighting to get an exception made for the Quakers on this. Sometimes he'll even join up with the Catholics, and the two of them will insist that the law should be gotten rid of. But if there was the slightest chance of it being gotten rid of for the Quakers and not for the Catholics, Penn would have thrown the Quakers under the bus in a heartbeat. But he's very busy. The guy has a lot of energy. He's here, there, everywhere. He's traveling around. He's on the continent preaching. He's a busy guy. In the midst of all of this, he decides that it would be really swell if he had his own colony over there in North America. And so he talks the king into, and we aren't entirely sure how, talks the king into giving him a hunk of territory, which obviously becomes the state of Pennsylvania, which he names after Pennsylvania obviously means Penn's Woods, and he names it after his father. He names it in honor of his father, not himself. And then, you know, their main city that he forms is Philadelphia, the city of brotherly love. So Penn now has his own colony, and this is sort of like his master, retirement plan and plan to support generations of Penns yet to be born, because after all, you own your own colony. I mean, it generates cash, right? And it's got all kinds of arrangements about, you buy the land and you send me money and blah, 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 blah. The people don't, however, since they're over here and he's over there, oddly forget to send him the money. So the monetary theory about this colony never really works out in Penn's life. Instead, he's pouring money into it, and they're trying to build it up to make it work. On top of that, he has a running feud with Maryland, which is a proprietary colony owned by the Lords Baltimore. That is to say, one Lord Baltimore after another. And they are Catholic. The charters between the two states are written not quite as clearly as one might want. And so there's a bit of wiggle room as to where exactly this borderline is. And Penn is most concerned about the fact that he needs to be able to have ships go up the Delaware River to Philadelphia in order to make this work, to make the colony work economically. He needs to be able to trade out of Philadelphia, which is a great seaport, but it's not on the ocean, obviously. You have to sail up, and you have to sail through New Jersey and Delaware. So there's this long-running fight for a while about whether Penn owns all of what is today Belle Delaware or part of what started out as the Delaware colony and ended up being part of Pennsylvania. Because he needs to be able to get his ships in there. Now, his ships can get in there. It's just the people in Delaware and New Jersey are going to tax him, which tax the ships, which means the merchants make less money, which means they send Penn less money, right? So this is important to Penn, very important to Penn. The description of where the line is somewhat vague, but basically the Lords Baltimore have the far better of it. If you read the description carefully, honestly, basically where they think the line should be drawn is probably where the line should be drawn. Penn, who is not stupid, probably recognizes this, but it's not in his interest to do that. So they come up with a lot of half-baked legal arguments about, it really means this and should be, miles, a few hundred miles, 100 miles or 50 miles or something farther north. Or farther south, blah, 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 blah. And this fight goes on until finally an agreement is made between Pennsylvania and New Jersey when they hire two gentlemen named Mason and Dixon to survey the line. And they do that between 1763 and 1767. And, of course, that's the Mason-Dixon line, which is the southern border of Pennsylvania, which is basically where the Lords Baltimore always said it was. But for a long time, there's this running feud between Pennsylvania and New Jersey about where the line is. All right. On the home front, Penn marries Guillaume Springnet, whom everyone calls Gully, and so I will, in 1672 when she was 28 and just a few years older than he was. He calls it a match of Providence's making. She is a Quaker and she comes from the gentry. She and Penn are about the only Quakers who come from the gentry. They live together. He is clearly loves her, writes her little love letters. When she dies, he writes memorials to her, blah, 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 blah. She dies on February 23, 1694. Penn is nearly 50 at this point. Gully lives with Penn during this period where he becomes more and more famous and gathers more assets, although it's not clear that it has to result in a lot of money. He goes to faith prison from time to time for his faith. He has growing influence with the king and in other important circles, and he has his own colony. So she's there during the build-up period. In November of 1694, nine months of mourning being apparently enough for William Penn, William Penn is in Bristol for the monthly or quarterly or something meeting of the Friends. He's there for 2 weeks. He knows all these people. He's been there many times. And while he's there, Hannah Callowhill catches his eye. Now, Hannah Callowhill was born on February 17th of 1671. She is a Quaker. She lives in Bristol. Her father is a linen draper. He makes linen, has made a lot of money. She is shy, does not speak much, but is very intelligent. Her father recognizes this and teaches her about business, including sort of rudimentary bookkeeping. So Penn's there visiting, and she catches his eye. Now, he would have met her before when she was younger, and she was just a kid, but at that point, he would be married, and she would be a kid. Now, however, she is 23, and he is a widower. And he becomes instantly smitten. He pays her a certain amount of attention, which semi-confuses her because, you know, flattered as she may be, she's not looking to pick up a 50-year-old husband at that point. Furthermore, there's a big social gap between the two of them. Unlike Gully, where both of them are from the gentry. Obviously, Penn is an extremely important person. He's from the gentry, very important in the Quakers, blah, blah. And, you know, her family, although well-to-do, is just a merchant family. They're not on the same social level at all. Penn then takes off and continues his traveling around. Hannah seems to have had no expectations of further contact with Penn, and why should she? It's fairly inconceivable that he has any great interest with her. By the middle of January of 1675, Penn is back in London, at which point his daughter Letitia, being a woman, women are much smarter about these things, picks up that Penn is in love with this woman back in Bristol. Nobody else much seems to have noticed, and she decides that it's too early in the relationship to start grilling her father about what is this all about, so she just lets it go for a while. Penn, however, has not forgotten about Hannah, and so starts, and Penn is a very persuasive person. He's filled with energy, used to pushing to get his way. So Penn starts an all-out attack upon the whole Callowhill family. He's not courting just Hannah, he's courting the whole family. He's writing her letters, twice as many letters as she writes to him. At one point he gets plaintive and says, "Well, you should write me more often." She doesn't, but he keeps writing to her. He writes to her mother and sends her recipes. He writes to her father, gives him legal advice and financial advice. He's doing everything he can. At one point, Letitia sends Hannah a pot of chocolate. You know, so the whole family has gotten in on this attack on poor Hannah. Her letters back are caring, but they're within the Quaker. She writes in the Quaker format, which is sort of caring for everybody, and it's not clear there's any particular focus on him, but that's mostly because she's in writing in a format which allows her to sort of stay out of having to commit herself too much, because it's hard to figure out, from her viewpoint, I'm sure it's hard to figure out what is going on here. Penn keeps it up, and finally, apparently, Hannah agrees to the marriage. However, marriage is not a simple matter. So they have to meet first with the men's meeting, because there's no point in having women around, right? The important decision to be made by men. However much women are equal, they aren't that equal. He meets with the men's meeting in Bristol to decide to get approval for the marriage. And they have a committee of two guys who have done an investigation and who report on the appropriateness of this marriage. Now imagine trying to get married in Westminster and you have to get approval by the session, which appoints a subcommittee to go out and investigate the two of you to decide whether it's a good idea in the mind of the session to have you get married, right? That's what we're doing here. So having been to the men's meeting in Bristol and gotten their approval, they now have to go to his home church, off in the sticks in England, and get their approval from their men's meeting. So this process takes a while because nothing happens very quickly. They're finally married on March 5th of 1696. She is 25. He is nearly 52. So let's think about these women. Both of these women are married relatively late, Gully particularly late. For her to be married at 27, she is on the absolute cusp if she hasn't already crossed over into old maidhood. These women are married in 16, 17, 18, 19 years old. First off, their fathers want to get rid of them. They're expensive, and they send them off to somebody else. It's why they give dowries. It's, you know, they're paying the guy to take the daughter off his hands. They're, you know, for a woman to wait so long to get married is very unusual. So Gully, particularly at 27, is like basically out of it. And at 24, Hannah is really pushing it. Now, the two women have had suitors, apparently. Gully is often described as really good-looking and Hannah not so much, although it's not clear that that's anything other than afterthought by people who are trying to create a story. Both of them have suitors. They choose not to get married. Both of them are devout Quaker women. Both of them are thinking of becoming Quaker ministers. And both of their fathers seem quite comfortable with them staying at home. Now, they've got money, so pushing the daughter out the door is quite not quite as important as for most fathers who, you know, as I say, don't need an expensive daughter hanging around any longer than absolutely necessary. So they're married late in life. Both of them are very capable at handling things. They're relatively well educated. Gully is very well educated. Both marriages are love affairs. The two wives love Penn. Penn loves them. Each of them has about 7 or 8 children by Penn. Penn had a lot of free time, apparently. The distinction in the numbers is that at least one of them had a child who was never named. And if the child isn't named when it died. Then often when people start adding up the children, they don't count the child that died almost immediately after birth. So at any rate, they both had 7 or 8 children. They were constantly pregnant, and when they weren't pregnant, they had children running around all the time. Although luckily they also have servants, so let's not feel too sorry for these women. Most of the children die before adulthood, so that when Penn marries Hannah, there are only 3 of Gully's children who are still surviving, and they all died quite young. Most importantly, not inconsequentially, let me just say, both of these women bring dowries of £10,000. Now, £10,000 in those days is a humongous amount of money. by any stretch of the imagination. These two fathers are very well to do. If they can, you know, write a check for, in effect, write a check for £10,000 in a time when you know, people lived on 5-10 pounds a year. I mean, ordinary people. This is a fantastic amount of money. So both of them bring considerable wealth with them when they come. Hannah takes over the whole family. She and Letitia seem to become great pals. They are with each other all the time. They like each other. They get along very well. Unfortunately, for Penn, within a month of the marriage, Springnet, his oldest surviving son, and the person whom he intends to take over the whole estate, including running Pennsylvania, dies. So within a month after she's married, Hannah has to deal with Springnet's death, or, you know, illness and death, and Penn's being somewhat distraught by that, not only because it's his son, but it's his oldest son, it's the one on whom he has placed all of his hopes and dreams for the way this is going to work out. And his existing will at that point basically puts Springnet in charge of everything. So that whole plan goes out the window. Hannah and William have different views of where to live. She likes cities, particularly she wants to live in Bristol near her family. He likes the countryside, which is where his estate is. He likes being out in the sticks, where it's quiet and serene, and he can think for a while and write, and people don't stop him and bother him. They work it out. They're sometimes they're one place, sometimes they're the other place. There's clearly negotiation between the two of them, and some give and take in all of this. So while Gully is with Penn on the upswing, Hannah arrives at the time when things are beginning to get out of hand. Penn has land and estates, has a whole colony over in North America, in theory. But, not in theory, he has a colony. He also has significant money problems. The colony is not, as I say, providing anything like the amount of money that it's supposed to be providing. No one pays him the rents they're supposed to, or very few people do. Or if they pay him rent, they aren't paying him enough in rents. He has these constant letters to the governors saying, collect my rents. And they're like, yeah. He sends people over to collect the rents, and nothing much ever happens. People just say, well, you know, we don't have the money, blah, blah, blah. He also has issues with the government. The government's not pleased with him about one thing or another, so he's sort of on the outs. And so things are difficult for Penn. He is... in trouble about one thing or another, and it's really wearing on him. So he takes off, however, and decides he needs to deal with the Pennsylvania problem. So in September of 1699, William, Hannah, her first child, because they start having children immediately, and Letitia take off and go to Pennsylvania. Penn, at that point, intends to live in his estate in Pennsylvania. He doesn't really plan to come back to England. He's going to stay right there and manage the colony, because, oddly enough, the colony runs better when he's there, because he sort of, it's harder to argue with him, and he gets everybody organized and gets them going in the direction he wants to go. The minute he leaves, things fall apart. So he's decided to stay there. And so he's planning to stay in Pennsylvania. But after 2 years, his money problems and the issues with the English government basically require him to return to England. He wants Hannah and the children and Letitia to stay in Pennsylvania. I'll be back, you know. And Hannah's like, no, I'm coming. So she comes. Now, we might pause to consider for a moment that this, although the people are sailing back and forth across the Atlantic, first off, it takes like 3 months. which is no fun being in a small wooden ship bounding around on the Atlantic. It's much better in an ocean liner on the QE2, right? This is not that. They're bounded around. They have little tiny cabins. When even if they have a cabin, you bang your head on the ceiling. I mean, it's very uncomfortable. You bang your head on the ceiling even if it's not, the boat isn't bounding up and down, which it is. It's rolling, it's rocking, it's, you know, all those things. There are three axes you can move on. Boats move on all of them. And ships are lost. I mean, people drown crossing the Atlantic. This is not something that you get up and do willy-nilly. Benjamin Franklin's wife would never go to England with him, although he begged and pleaded and would write to her once he was there, asking her to come. She would never come, and clearly part of it was she thought this crossing the Atlantic thing was too dangerous, and this is 100 years later, or 80 years later. This crossing the Atlantic thing is not easy. So for Hannah to get up and Gully never went to Pennsylvania. Penn went to Pennsylvania, but she never went. Hannah goes with him and insists on coming back with him. So we're back in England. Penn has a particularly ugly money problem, and the particularly ugly money problem is that he trusted his head financial manager, because, I mean, there's too much going on. He's got to have somebody to help him, right, whose name was Philip Ford. Philip Ford and his wife, actually, together are crooks. They're happily defrauding Penn, left and right. And then they keep claiming that they're owed more and more money for the services they're performing, which is defrauding him. And so they keep getting him to sign documents where he promises to repay them and gives them mortgages on this or that. And Penn's busy, and one of these is signed just as he's on the boat in 1699, getting ready to go to Pennsylvania. They show up and say, well, here's another, you know, something might happen to you. We need you to protect our interests, blah, 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 blah. Penn doesn't have time to read the documents, doesn't have time to hire a new manager or anything. And so, you know, he signs this stuff, all of which is as if anyone needed any more proof. Don't sign documents without getting your lawyer to look at them. Penn has now owes the Fords a ridiculous amount of money, at least on paper, according to the Fords' documents, and they want to collect. So all of this goes into the court system. Now, if you think the U.S. court system is slow, you ain't seen nothing compared with the British court system of the 18th century. It took forever for anything to happen. And so years and years of fighting goes on with the Ford. In fact, Philip Ford dies, and his wife carries on the fight to collect their, you know, their ill-gotten gains. Penn hits upon the idea that perhaps he'd like, you know, one way out of all of this is to sell the colony to the crown. And so in the early part of 1700, as he gets back to England, he starts negotiating with the crown to buy the colony. And he says, I'll sell you the colony for £20,000. And they say, well, we might consider buying the colony, but only for 12. Penn says, all right, well, I'll consider 12. And negotiations linger on forever and ever, but nothing ever happens. And I have always thought, is that clear why? I suppose if you mucked around in the archives in Westminster, you might find out. But you can't, my guess is the British government looked at the king and his advisors looked at the colony and said, it's not making any money. Why would we take over something that's not making money and we have to pour more money into? Let Penn pour money into it. At some point, if we really want it, we'll just take it. After all, we're the king, right? So Penn, that path doesn't work. Penn is, in 1708, Penn is finally imprisoned for his failure to pay his debts to basically the Fords. Friends get together and raise the money to buy off the, well, to get him out of jail, but also to buy off the Fords. The Fords, Mrs. Ford finally realizes that she's not going to get anything like all of what they're asking. She's asking for, and so she agrees to take like 6,600 pounds, which is a ridiculous amount of money under any circumstances, and way more than they're entitled to. But at any rate, she's entitled to. But at any rate, that's what they agree to. Penn doesn't have anything like that, and has to basically borrow it from the Friends community, which comes up with the money, including 1,000 pounds of it that comes from his father-in-law. Hannah's father, which must be somewhat awkward. So they, you know, they're, however, good businessmen. They get a mortgage on everything in sight to support this debt that he owes to them. But at least he's out of jail. In 1709, Penn suffers his first stroke, which disables him a bit. In 1712, he suffers his second stroke. He declines from then on and dies on July 30 of 1718. He is 73, which is extremely old for that time. I mean, anybody who lives to 73 is like, might as well be 110, right? People just didn't live that long. Hannah is now thrust into the position of having to manage the family affairs. She has to manage the affairs all during the 6 years that his health is declining. She also is caring for him, although we can't get too, don't expand on that too much, because of course she's got servants all over the place, so it's not like she has to bring broth every minute to him. There are lots of people to help her, but nonetheless, she's got an ill husband who is clearly not going to get better and is eventually going to die from all of this. He can talk and whatever, but he can't really, obviously isn't the energy to manage the affairs of the family, so she has to do it. When he dies, she continues to do this because she is the executrix of his will and the guardian of their 5 children. So she's in the middle of the 5 children that they have had that are still living. So they are in the middle of, or she's in the middle of all of that. Furthermore, Penn gives the land in Pennsylvania, a little of it to each of his children, but the vast bulk of it goes to Hannah. So Hannah is far and away the largest landowner in Pennsylvania. He, however, splits the government of Pennsylvania away from the land. So he establishes 12 trustees, some on each side of the Atlantic, to manage the colony. Hannah isn't one of the trustees, but she's in the middle of all of this because she's the biggest landholder. She's Penn's wife. They come and chat with her, blah, 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 blah. They don't always agree. She's always in the middle of this and is basically the temporary proprietor until she dies. There isn't an official job title, but that's, you know, what she's doing. She's doing an awful lot of managing of what's going on. on top of all of this, as if the poor woman doesn't have enough problems, the oldest living son from Gully's marriage, William Jr., has decided he doesn't like the way the will is, and he's challenged the will. So the will is now in court for, 8 years of, slow British litigation, while he tries to break the will, which he's very confident he's going to do. The confusion goes on about, so on top of everything else poor Hannah's dealing with, she has this ongoing legal fight. She's trying to pay off the mortgage to all of these people, all the Quakers she owes that, the estate owes money to, including her father. She's trying to raise kids, and all of her kids are minor children, And she's trying to run the estate. She's got lands in Pennsylvania. She's got trustees to deal with. They replace two governors while she's alive. This woman has a lot of challenges to deal with. There she is. Finally, after all of this litigation, the will is upheld, and William Jr. goes away. But, you know, this is just one drain after another on the poor woman. In the midst of all of this, she makes an attempt, which she can't exactly do directly. At one point, she tried to get in touch with the Lord Baltimore to negotiate something about the thing, and he, of course, says, no way. Because after all, why would anyone meet with a woman, right? She, however much she may be equal in the Quaker religion, she's not equal in the larger society, so she obviously has no ability to bind anything about anything, so why pay any attention to her? But at any rate, through all of these people that she's connected with, she negotiates some sort of temporary arrangement with the Lord Baltimore to deal somewhat with this border dispute. You know, again, trying to get free passage into Philadelphia for ships coming up. At one point, Penn has suggested, you know, why don't we just all agree amongst us colony people not to tax each other? And which is the sensible answer. Everybody's free. We just all make money. What the heck? The British government says, no. Nobody's making any decisions about taxation, blah, 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 except through us. So we don't want any of the colonies starting making decisions on their own and running off and doing things. So no. So that's shot down. So she makes some deal. It's temporary. It doesn't last long. As I say, the whole thing drags on until 1767. Hannah dies in 1726, which is like 14 years after William, and at the age of 55. The Penn's wives are not surprisingly basically ignored by history. I say not surprisingly in that they don't appear to be to have individual roles other than being wives. And so that doesn't make for very interesting biographies. So no one really writes anything about them. Also, they tended to be quiet. They did not speak in the meeting house. They wrote letters, but about family matters and stuff. There's nothing all that, in the end, you know, exciting about them that would cause people to write a book. And on top of that, of course, once you start getting into either of them, you get swamped by William Penn. I mean, William Penn is a huge personality. It's like Donald Trump, if you want to pick a, you know, he's got money. He bowls people over with his enthusiasm, and he's, unlike Trump, he's very logical and very impressive in person, and he has just a tremendous impact on everybody he's around. You know, he's a huge force in growing the Quaker religion. He's spectacular, and anybody, I don't care who it is going to be, you know, not look very important in comparison with William Penn. Because if you start writing about either of these ladies, and immediately you start writing about Penn, and you write about Penn for on, and they get back to the ladies, right? Who are home being good Quaker women, like all the other good Quaker women. They're caring for their families, they attend meetings, they're, let's just say, worship services. They do the things they're supposed to do, but you know, nothing much particularly beyond that. Hannah particularly falls into a terrible mythology issue about, you know, well, Gully was prettier and Hannah was more practical, and you know, there are a whole bunch of over time, starting in like the 19th century, Hannah's story comes and goes and runs around, and people say all kinds of strange things about it. with no particular historical foundation. They just do. For a long period of time, they have her birth date wrong by, 30 years. it's taken a long time for the history to even to catch up with her. And then, unfortunately, Hannah had a couple of opinions about things in general which would not be very acceptable at the moment. So that's just another reason not to get into too much about Hannah. But both of these women clearly, play a part in Penn's life. They are rather interesting in their own way. There's just, however, not a lot of historical data about them. For instance, we have no idea what they look like, either of them. Well, there are paintings of them, allegedly about them, but they're paintings that were made years and years after they were dead by people who said, we think she looked like that, and the painter's painting. It's like getting a crime scene sketch, I sort of remember that the criminal looked like this. Well, I sort of remember that Gully looked like this, and so we have paintings, but they aren't, they're entirely made up. So we have no idea what the women looked like. So that's the Hannah Penn story and the William Penn story and the Gully story. It's quite interesting from a historical viewpoint about what there was going on. So that's all I know about that. It's 10-2. If somebody wants to ask a couple questions, we can take 2 minutes to do that. Otherwise, we can either go to church or go home or whatever you're planning to do. But thank you all for coming. I had a good time doing this, as you can tell. So thank you. John.
Did Quakers support education for female children? At least it was obviously.
Yes, they did. Although there's a limit to that. I mean, they wouldn't start Quaker schools. They would have been homeschooled. And particularly because, like in Hannah's case, her father would know that if she's not getting married, he needs her to help in the business. Or two, if she marries another Quaker merchant, it probably doesn't hurt if she knows about business, because after all, these guys die. And they end up, in charge. And frankly, if you're like Hannah or Gully, and your husband dies, this is for a woman the greatest, other than the loss of your husband. Well, let's not, I don't mean to make fun of that. But it's great because finally you're free. You don't have your father to tell you what to do. You don't have a husband to tell you what to do. You are free, and in the law, you suddenly have powers that you never had before. It's not surprising that the women who had money and didn't have to remarry often didn't, because this is great, if they found some guy they fell in love with, that's one thing. Or if there was some reason but basically, they people came and they wanted to get married. Well, of course, they wanted their money, And they said, no. George Washington loved Mary Custis, but the fact of the matter that she was the richest widow in Virginia did not hurt her attraction. the two of them fell in love, they got married, but Martha could have remained free. She had all this money. She could hire all the people to do all. She didn't need a man to tell her what to do. So, and these two women are fairly independent. I think they would have. So they did train their women. Gully was better educated, although again she couldn't have gone to university. But she was better educated because she was in the gentry than Hannah was. But Hannah was quite good. Hannah could do double entry bookkeeping. Although after a short period of time she stopped doing it for the Pennsylvania because it was all outgo. She said, "You don't need the other side of the column because there's no income." All right. Well, thank you.